since we're speaking of false hope and they continue to run the false ad, there is no cross of Billy Graham. There's no cross of Jesus Christ. There is no Jesus. There is no Easter. There is no cross. All of those things are false. No one named Jesus lived in the first century of the Common Era. No one named Jesus even existed prior to the 17th century. That's when the name was first created. It bears absolutely no resemblance of any kind to the actual name of the individual it claims to be describing. There's no basis for Jesus anywhere in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, or even in the Christian New Testament. It is a completely contrived name. If you do not know his name, you do not know him. If your religion has lied to you about the name of the individual they claim founded their religion, what else have they lied to you about? Easter is purely Babylonian. The name was conceived in Babylon. It is part of the sun god myths of the Babylonian pagan religion. It has no basis whatsoever in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. In fact, God speaks vociferously against celebrations like Christmas and Easter. He hates them. They're an abomination to him. And there is no cross. No, nothing even remotely like a cross. Not in the Torah, not in the prophets, not in the Psalms, not even in the Christian New Testament. The concept that's in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms presented throughout the Torah is Edom. Edom is an extremely important concept if you want to know who God is and what he has done for us. Edom is the upright pillar of the tabernacle. It's what secures the covering of the tabernacle and enables the tabernacle, which is another word for home, this case Yahweh's home, which would be for the covenant family, to be enlarged. The upright one is a reference, the metaphor, one of the most common metaphors in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms for Yahusha, the corporeal manifestation of Yahweh. He is the upright one, the one who stood up for us so that we could stand with him. Standing with him is an essential part of knowing who God is and what he's offering. He doesn't want us bowing down to him. He wants us standing with him. And so he took a stand on our behalf so that we could stand with him. That's what Edom conveys. That's what it means to be the upright one. It's all conveyed by Kum. It's in the campfire song that so many people miss. Kumbaya. Stand in Yah. Stand with Yah. Kum, the Hebrew word for to take a stand. Now, as it relates to this pagan notion of a cross, and you say, oh boy, if I read my King James Bible, I see cross all over the place. You can't tell me there's no cross in the Bible? Yeah, I can tell you that. Because it doesn't exist. The Greek word that cross is has been convoluted into replacing is stirrups. And it means upright pillar, upright pole. It is a translation of the Hebrew word Edom, almost identical to the Hebrew word Edom. In fact, stirrups is even based on the Greek word histemi. Histemi is to take a stand so as to enable others to stand. It reflects the meaning behind Edom. And yet, Christians are desperate to have a cross. Why are they desperate to have a cross? Because Constantine, who along with Paul founded the Christian religion, established the Christian religion. Constantine saw the cross, which was the sign of his god, Mithras, emblazoned on his god, which was the sun, and heard a voice, it happened to be Satan's voice, saying, under this sign, conquer. And therein became the Christian cross. Sometime in the 5th century, Stiros, upright pillar, was replaced with the Latin crux, or cross. That's how it all migrated. Yet, since the term doesn't appear, since there is no such reference, if your religion has lied to you about the its most dominant symbol, what else have they lied to you about? And why, after knowing now that they've lied to you, do you still trust them if you're still a Christian? I said it about an hour ago that I wanted to change the topic that I had in Epiphany. I've done something today that I promised not to do. We spent the second hour having a conversation with Glenn about why it is appropriate, even if you're going to be amongst the few saying it, to turn to the Torah, prophets, and Psalms and convey what God has to say. Most logical, reasonable thing you can do. And that was different than answering Adam Miller's questions, which from GCN I had promised to do, and we will do perhaps in the second hour on Monday, since the second hour tomorrow will be with IQ Hour Rasuli. But we did indirectly answer many of his questions as to how we came to this position, how we came to know what we know, why we're sharing this, where this information comes from. And so that was a productive thing to do. But and I'm glad we did it. The conversation with Glenn was profound all the way through this process. But the epiphany, the change of subject that I suggested over an hour ago happened to be cross-related. And since this ad from Billy Graham has brought it up, I want to talk about it. A friend of mine sent me this morning an article. It happens to be on the Shroud of Turin. And what I have said is that, well, my knowledge of Yahweh is not based on it being real, and I don't want to attest to the fact that it is real. There are so many affirmations in the Shroud of Turin that seem credible. I am, personally, I have concluded after considering the evidence that it is real, that it was the linen wrap that was placed around the body of Yahusha before that body ceased to exist. Now, at the time that I began to consider the evidence, I've considered the evidence after a long evaluation of Psalm 22 and Psalm 88, which provide an eyewitness account to crucifixion that explain exactly how crucifixion works. And they go into enormous detail. Now, these were written about 1,000 BCE, 500 years before crucifixion was invented by the Assyrians, and 1,000 years before it was perfected by the Romans. And it describes Roman crucifixion 1,000 years before it occurred. And when I came to realize all the various ways that from this eyewitness account on crucifixion, how crucifixion kills its victim, and how what actually occurred on Pesach Passover in 33 CE, year 4000 Yah, I was drawn to the shroud because it's in the image on that cloth shows exactly what one would expect. And scientifically, medically accurate, here in the case of that particular artifact, 1,500 years before we actually understood the process of crucifixion. One thing about crucifixion, it's interesting that the way that it works is that with a person hanging by their arms, with their arms above their head, not outstretched as the Christian view of it is portrayed, but with their arms upstretched above their head, that the diaphragm doesn't work properly. And when the chest muscles are stretched, it becomes impossible to breathe in. And when that happens, when you can't take a deep breath, fluids begin to fill in your lungs. The crucifixion victim feels this enormous thirst because the fluids in their body are all pooling in their lungs. They're unbelievably thirsty, and yet they're drowning in their own fluids. And then the toxic waste in the blood can't be, and in the lungs can't be expelled. And so your heart becomes extremely weak. And while your bones aren't broken, they all come out of their socket. Your ligaments are stretched. Your all of the sockets and the joints of the, you know, the elbows and the wrists and the shoulders all become disjointed. And the only way that a victim in crucifixion can survive more than an hour or so is if they can push up on their feet. And why the while the depictions we have of crucifixion show, you know, 2 feet side by side, nailed directly through the bones that ultimately become our toes. That's not how it was done. The two legs were put side by side, if you will, twisted, and then one nail was driven through the heel, just behind the ankle and the heel. And for a short period of time, at excruciating agony, you could push up on that nail with excruciating agony. And by pushing up on the nail, you would stop this stretching mechanism of hanging from your wrists. And it, the nails weren't driven in the hand. If you drove a nail in the hand, it would just pull right through and then, you know, would do no good at all. The nail was actually driven through the wrist, just below the where the arm and the wrist intersect. And there's a nerve there that's excruciating again when it is pierced. And that's the nerve that they nail through. And the process then of pushing up on the heels is the only thing that enables you to breathe. And you can only do it so long because you become so weak with the toxics building up in your system and your lungs fill with fluids. And this is how they die. And so I looked at the Shroud of Turin and depict all of this. All of it's depicted. Right there in the image. And then something I didn't even know at the time is that Yosha's physical body had to be destroyed that night. It had to be incinerated. And that's exactly how the image appears on the shroud. Energy incinerating the body, leaving this photo negative on the limit, on the piece of linen. And so it looked to me as real. Now we'll get to the point. After the commercial break. Welcome back to Shatteringness. We're talking about the Christian cross and how that image, which is a vertical pole with a cross beam that is mounted two-thirds to three-quarters the way up so that the vertical pole exists below and above the cross beam. So it's in the shape of a lowercase T versus a capital T, is wrong. You see, it was apparent for a lot of reasons. Most interesting, from my perspective, was this correlation between edone and then the Greek term steros and its basis systemi. That the implement of physical death for the body of Yosha was an upright pole. And the Christian cross I knew from research was a pagan implement. It really came as initially into the religious nomenclature through Tammuz. The first letter of Tammuz's name was used to convey this concept of a pagan cross. So I then began to do a little research and found out that that wood had become very scarce, particularly long, sturdy beams in Israel. They had olives, and olive was about the only tree of consequence. They had over-harvested the cedars of Lebanon, and so about 1,000 years prior. And so the only wood that was available of any consequence was olive, and the main trunk of an olive isn't very tall, and it's extraordinarily rare to take an olive and to take it out of production and to use it for this upright pillar. And I recognize that it made no sense to constantly replace the upright pillar Nor did it make any sense to try to nail the crossbeam into that pillar, A, with the enormous value of nails made out of iron and the value of iron at the time. But also, once you've nailed that crossbeam into the upright, and you've done it a number of times, you're going to destroy both. They're not reusable, and reusing it was essential. And so began to study it, and what I found is that in the limestone of Jerusalem, particularly of Mount Moriah, that the Romans would dig would chisel out a receptacle. Let's just say on average about 7 inches, 8 inches by 8 inches, a square receptacle. And they would chisel that down into the limestone, about 8 inches. So imagine a square hole cut into the ground, chiseled into the limestone that is about 8 inches by 8 inches by 8 inches. And then they would take an upright pillar of wood, an edon in Hebrew, a steros in Greek, and they would set that into that receptacle where it would remain. And it would be, on average, maybe about 7 to 8 feet tall above the ground. And it would stay there. This idea that you pick up the entire cross and carry it is nonsense. That's not what happened. That beam, the upright beam, stayed in place right there. And then what they would do is that they would take the horizontal beam that the individual's wrists would be affixed to, initially roped and then later nailed. And they would, rather than it remaining in place, it wouldn't be almost impossible to, and the whole work of getting somebody, you have the pictures that they have in movies of you being nailed to the cross that you carried while you're laying flat on your back, and then the person and the cross being lifted, and then the jolt to the body. That's nonsense. Not how it worked. It was a much shorter cross member than is depicted in the Christian myth and in the Christian cross, about maybe a third as long. And it was not affixed to the pole two-thirds or three-quarters of the way up. It's so logical what the Romans did. They simply cut out a notch on the cross member. And they simply had a raised portion on the top of the pole, and they lifted that short beam and set it on top. Not going anywhere. Doesn't need to be nailed. Can always be reused. Putting it all together, there's another affirmation, and that's why I mentioned the Shroud of Turin. This article was sent to me today that confirms that the victim who is displayed in the Shroud of Turin, that when they were crucified, their arms weren't outstretched as you will find them on the pagan Christian cross. Nope, they were directly over the victim's head. Exactly what I had concluded. Now, those two things. One is, since if this was a fraud, there would have been no reason for the fraudulent artist to have depicted the crucifixion victim with arms directly over their head, because by that time, if this was a medieval forgery, there were a few billion, that might be a slight extrapolation or exaggeration, crucifixes all over Roman Catholic cathedrals, and this depiction has the person, the nail driven through the wrist, not through the hands, as they are in the Catholic Church crucifixion, has the nail driven through the back of the heel, not through the front of the foot, as is in the Christian depiction. And it shows a person that endured Roman crucifixion exactly as the Romans did it, but on an implement that isn't even remotely akin to the pagan Christian cross. If Christianity has lied to you about this, what else have they lied to you about? And speaking of the cross of Billy Graham and its connection with Easter, and then they're talking about in the power of the resurrection, according to Yahweh, there was no resurrection. No bodily resurrection. It'd be counterproductive. It would be completely counter to his Torah instructions. As a matter of fact, if there had been a bodily resurrection, then Yahweh or Yahusha, whoever was responsible for it, would be a liar, undependable, no longer a valid sacrificial lamb. Read what Yahweh wrote in his Torah about Passover. Read about what happens to the remaining parts of the body of that lamb after the lamb has served its purpose. It's incinerated, just as the Shroud of Turin depicts. No longer exists. And it's only the physical body that succumbs. The soul of that lamb was not killed, just as the soul of God was not killed. It had work to do. Matzah. Yahusha's soul, we're told in the 22nd Psalm and the 88th Psalm and Yashaya 53 that the soul of Yahweh had work to do. Went into Sheol on our behalf, on matzah, to remove the fungus of sin from our souls, making us perfect in God's eyes, so that we could be born anew from above in spirit on Bakurim, which means firstborn children, just as he was with soul and spirit reunited, the body long gone. That's why no one recognized him. If your religion has lied to you about Easter, about Jesus, about the cross, about bodily resurrection, how many more lies do you need to hear before you're going to say, they're not trustworthy, they're not worthy of my soul, and you're going to walk away from them? Because until you walk away from them, you have no chance of developing a relationship with Yahweh or being saved by him. It is the prerequisite of the covenant. So, Glenn, I know you're still listening. I can hear some noise in the background. It was the story of the cross and how it too was false that I wanted to share, and how something as initially unbelievable as the Shroud of Turin correctly depicts what actually occurred. Whether it's true or not, it depicts what the way that crucifixion took place, emphasizing the upright nature of the pole upon which the upright right. hung, so we could stand upright with him.
Right, and that's and I'm thinking. I mean, I know a lot of Christians who are receptive to such like historical corrections. Many people, are now aware of the fact that nails didn't go through the feet. They went, I'm not even sure about as you're talking about in the heel. Many people aren't aware of that, but they're certainly aware that the nails didn't go through the hands, that they went down below the joint at the wrist, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So I think, part of the reason I'm not quite as anxious as you to be quite so vehement against Christians per se is because, I think many people, well, as you sort of said yesterday about people from, Missouri or the Ozarks, the mm-hmm. people who are away from urban areas are receptive, independently thinking individuals, mm-hmm. Receptive to truth. And
yes.
The same thing. I mean, I find I think many Christians would be receptive to the, historical corrections you just articulated.
Yeah, of course. But of course, the historical correction has to go beyond the image of the Christian cross. It has to go beyond that to obliterate connections with Easter.
And to
obliterate corrections with a bodily resurrection. So you've got so many things and if you're willing to take the first step, and by the way, I begin the show by saying that the fastest growing and largest segment of our society today are those who've come to realize that there are problems with such things, including their religion. And so I do think there are enormous numbers of people who would still consider themselves Christian who are no longer going to church, who have realized that there's something dreadfully wrong with what is being preached in their churches and have begun to question it. And that's the first step. That's an important first step. And those are the folks we're trying to reach. And I think there's actually a disproportionate number of responsible thinking people in the heartland of America than there are at the fringes. So I'm extraordinarily hopeful, and as it relates to people being willing to reject the lies and embrace the truth, which is why I constantly say, how many times does that religion have to lie to you before you finally say, you know, it's not worthy of my soul, it's not trustworthy?
Well, given that it's not possible, it's not really, it may not be possible, it's not desirable for one to wipe the slate of one's mind clean so it's become sort of some Cartesian tabula rasa and start over. It's pretty much people are going to piece through and correct their misnotion. And in Christianity, you know, the discipline of Christology, you know, that looks at all these things, who was the Christ, well, you know, what was the sequence of events. So, I mean, okay, that's fine, you know. So, like, what you were articulating would, you know, would be the sequence of events in your Messiology, I guess, is the necessary translation. And that would be systematized because everybody's going to ask the same question. It's like, okay, now we understand what you're saying about how Christ changed, you know, from the time of, from the time that he was, you know, put upon the death bowl, you know, and all that sort of thing. People might be willing, you know, hesitant to modify their terminology. But the questions all have to be answered one by one, and it's like, that makes sense. Right. And you end up displacing the misnotions with the new corrected notion.
I've just put Glenn on hold here. Everything he said is absolutely accurate. But Glenn, we really do need to buy you a new telephone. The voice quality is just got to be so bad that I couldn't bear it on behalf of our listeners. But keep in mind, everything that he just said is true. And it's that process that is extremely important. I mean, it's not just what Glenn said is true. It's how important what he said is to all of us to appreciate. None of us go through an immediate cleansing of our slate. We're not capable of it. I didn't go from evangelical Christian, from ordained ruling elder in the Presbyterian Church, perhaps if maybe even the youngest ever, to leading Bible studies and all of that sort of thing, to becoming an agnostic, and then to becoming part of Yahweh's family and rejecting Christianity in a day. It was a long journey, a very long journey. And there's aspects of the Christian myths that I'm sure still cling to me. I find myself rejecting them one after another. It's the very process that Glenn says that he's on is the process that I have been on and continue to be on. And the next thing that Glenn said is equally important. It's not just that we're going on a voyage of discovery, and as we learn new things, we are erasing from our memory, from our acceptance, those things which are found to be untrue, and replacing them with that which is true. There's something about this journey that is extraordinary, and that is that all of the little details And with this upright pillar, and you might say, you know, what's the big difference between an upright pillar that's in the foundation of the bedrock there of Mount Moriah that just has a small horizontal piece set right on the top of versus the Christian cross? Boy, those details just seem so small. But they're not. Each of them has great merit. And when you understand why each of them is so important, and how each time you understand why it is that way, say, oh, yeah, wow, that makes sense. Okay. Oh, well, that's consistent. Oh, that's another insight. Yes, that piece fits too. And as you watch each of these details, each of these pieces make sense and fit and collectively interconnect as the most beautiful picture is formed before your eyes, vivid, detailed, precise, consistent from every viewpoint and every angle, after a while, you just begin to trust the author that presented this picture. Welcome back to the final segment of Shattering This for today. The message here is that I am surprised. I am stunned, as a matter of fact, that this appears to be the only radio program, and perhaps even the only series of books between yadayah.com and introtogod.org, even questioningpaul.com, that are willing to share with you what Yahweh, which is God's one and only name, had to say about himself, what he actually conveyed to us, to demonstrate how different what God revealed is, God's testimony is, from the religious myths that claim to be based upon his inspiration. You know, it is surprising. And the reason it's surprising is that all I had to do is go to the most obvious place, to the beginning, to Bereshith, which is Genesis, to Shemoth, which is Exodus, to Kara, which is Leviticus, and through the Torah, which means teaching. Just to go to those books and look at the words. I didn't have to learn to speak Hebrew. In fact, speaking Hebrew would probably be a liability. What I had to do was to be willing to invest the time to buy interlinears, to buy scholarly tomes on the history of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the text of the Dead Sea Scrolls, so I could have access to the earliest manuscripts, and then buy a series of lexicons so that rather than relying on one academic source, I could rely on 5, 10, 15 or more on not only the meaning of the words, but the roots of the words. And that so I could do a little due diligence and say, all right, now I'm looking at the actual letters. How were these letters originally written? And to study the history of the Hebrew alphabet and to realize that there's a lexicon just in the shape of the letters. A lexicon meaning a definition of what the words mean when they're comprised of certain letters, because the letters were all pictures. And then to use those things. You know, initially I did it all through paper. I've got interlinear after interlinear. I've got 20 books on the Dead Sea Scrolls. I've got 20 Hebrew or English lexicons and dictionaries. And then I bought some concordances, which share with you where else a word is used. So if you're trying to define a word, you can look up the first time that word's used. You can look up subsequent times that word's used, and to make sure that your definition is consistent, and to see how the context defines the word. And so you buy these tools, and then you take a little time and say, you know, well, I'm going to study Hebrew grammar. I want to make sure that I'm conveying this correctly. And you learn, well, in Hebrew, they've got stems. Well, stem, what's a stem? Well, it denotes a relationship between the subject and the object of the sentence through the action of the verb. And it talks about that relationship. And then in Hebrew, there are no tenses in the sense of time. And no Hebrew verb is stuck in time like English verbs are. There's no past, present, or future tense. But instead, a perfect and imperfect, which let us know if an action is complete or if it is ongoing. And then there are moods, with almost all of the moods conveying volition, free will, choice. And so you put all that together and then you go word for word. What was said? Amplify it. Look at it under a microscope, if you will. And try to learn every nuance of every word so that you might understand what is being said. And just then go through the Torah as Yahweh revealed it. And then there's this issue of God's name. Come to find out, every place you read Lord in your English Bible, 7,000 times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, where you read Lord, that's not what's there. Come to find out, Yahweh told us in Jeremiah, that the replacement of his name with the satanic title Lord is the single most devastating thing, destructive thing humankind has ever done. And you find 7,000 times Yahweh wrote his name. Yod, hey, wah, hey. And you just do a bit of research and you find that those four letters, actually three letters, one's repeated, represents three of the five vowels in the Hebrew language. And you examine the other words that are so common in Hebrew, like Torah, and it becomes obvious how to pronounce his name. It's Yahweh. None of this is difficult. It just takes time and an open mind. We'll be back tomorrow.